Bruce Kernan is a certified seaplane flight instructor, master captain with a Coast Guard license. He's appeared in multiple documentaries about the Bermuda Triangle. The current book, Bermuda Triangle Survivor. Also check out Beyond the Bermuda Triangle. Website, electronicfog.com. In this interview, he includes more of his personal UFO encounters, and it started when he was a kid. And I think that's the most important aspect, because he's able to survive and give detailed evidence about what he experienced, where others haven't been so lucky.
You go in one end of the wormhole, and when you come out the other, you're in a different place and a different time. That's what I think happened.
Bruce Kernan has written the definitive book and has the most current and most amazing and possibly ahead of the curve information about the Bermuda Triangle, because he flew through it and experienced something that would be absolutely phenomenal if we can get the science to back it up. And not only that, that other people may experience it. So Bruce Kernan, you have updated some of your information, also including new videos to show people exactly what it was like when you experienced this time anomaly as you flew through the Bermuda Triangle. Thank you for giving us an in-depth, up-close, and personal look, because it's hard to explain, but looking at it in the videos, it's amazing the things that you saw. So would you like to explain right off the bat what happened when you flew through? This was 1970?
Yeah, and first of all, thank you for having me on your show, Wendy. Yeah, you're right about mainstream science needs to find out about this. That's like my main goal. For the rest of my life, I'm going to try to get mainstream science to verify this, because as far as mainstream is concerned, there's no such thing as the Bermuda Triangle or electronic fog. That's my main theory in regards to the mystery. No such thing as that either. But some of the scientists are starting to catch on, so I'll keep working on it. What would you like me to talk about first?
You already were a pilot, so you had some experience flying back and forth in that area through the what is considered the triangle. But what happened that time that was different? Could you walk us through that?
You want me to walk you through the flight from beginning to end, but keep it kind of brief?
An overview.
Okay. Right. It was December 4th, 1970. Took off from Palmage International on the day before that. And we flew to Andros Island in the Bahamas, where we were working on a construction project there. And then we planned on coming back on Friday the next day. We were flying our Bonanza, a new A-36 Beechcraft Bonanza. Planned on leaving first thing in the morning, but they had no phones on that island back then. So when we got up first thing in the morning, there was this overcast and heavy rain, thunderstorms. So. And we had to delay the flight, and then finally it started to dissipate around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we headed out to the airport, pre-flighted the plane. It was my dad was the co-pilot, and he was also a licensed pilot. And we had a business partner, Chuck Lafayette, with us. Now, I was the pilot in command, so it was fair enough for us to take off, just a light rain going on. So we went ahead and took off, and I lifted off at exactly 3 p.m. But back then, the watches and the timing of the flight was critical, because we didn't have these modern-day instruments. We did have some navigation equipment, but nothing compared to what they have today. No moving map would really change technology a lot. So we would time everything and look for certain waypoints, they were called, to make sure everything's working right on time. So when we departed, we stayed about 1,000 feet because it was overcast at 1,500 feet over the entire island. We headed out over the interior of the island and aimed towards the Great Bahama Bank, and on the other side of the Great Bahama Bank was the island of Bimini, which we would be able to pick that up with one of our navigational instruments, a direction finder. And when we got to the shoreline, we could see the blue skies and no storms, so it looked good. Except there was this one little cloud offshore, maybe a couple of miles. It was a little bit odd looking at it because it was shaped like a lenticular cloud. And that's a cloud that has some smooth edges, shaped like a lens of a camera. It was sort of just hovering out there, about 500 feet above the ocean. And it was about a mile long and half a mile wide, about 1,000 feet thick. And it just happened to be right in our flight path. If you're heading directly to Bimini, it looked harmless. So I didn't think too much about it, so I just kept on flying, and we started to ascend. We were planning on going to 10,500 feet. So I started my ascent as soon as we got free of the overcast on the island. Climbed up right over this cloud. And when I got to about 3,000 feet, I was able to contact Miami air traffic control to get my flight plan on file and also get a weather report. So they said the weather was clear between Andros and Miami, so that was good news. They did say that there were some widely scattered thunderstorms in South Florida, but said I should have no problem getting around them as we were planning on going to Palm Beach International Airport. So after I got off the radio with the controllers, I looked down and I saw that this cloud was right below the airplane. I was like, wow, what is going on here? That's really odd. Apparently the little lenticular cloud, it turned into the birth. I thought it would be the birth of a cumulonimbus thunderstorm, and it was rising up rapidly. It caught us in the airplane when we got to about 5,000 feet. It was climbing faster than we could climb, so I had to go inside it. It seemed like a normal cloud when I got inside, and the visibility was shut down only 100 feet or so. And I would be able to pop right out of the cloud after being in there only maybe 30 seconds or so because it had the updraft. But then I'd climb up above it and get a couple hundred feet above it, and then it would catch up to us again, and we'd go back in it. And this went on about five different times. Finally, when we got to like our assigned altitude of 10,500, my dad suggested that we turn back to Andros. He was getting a little nervous, I guess. Told him, well, let's go a little bit higher before we turn back. I was thinking maybe we could still break free of this storm. Besides, I didn't want to turn back into it because I wasn't sure what was going on. The way it was building up, it would probably be dangerous to turn around and go back into the storm. So when we got to 10,500 feet, we finally broke free of the cloud. I leveled off the cruise speed, 195 miles an hour. And when I looked behind me and on the sides, I was amazed at what I saw. This little cloud had it spread out on either side of me as far as I could see. It built up now to probably 30,000 feet already, spread out in the shape of a semicircle, which was really odd. It looked like a perfect semicircle instead of having like scallops in it. I figured it was just a squall, and not just an isolated thunderstorm anymore. It just happened to turn into a squall. So I leveled off, and I'm cruising, and it got behind me, and I didn't worry about it anymore. Tried to relax and get back while we're cruising at high speed, and I maintained my altitude of 11,500 for some reason. I always felt safer the higher we went when we flew into the Bahamas. After only about 5 minutes, I looked in front of me, and now here's another storm, I thought. And again, it was had a circular, semi-circular shape to it, and it was like a perfectly shaped form, which was odd, and now it was over 40,000 feet up. I thought, well, maybe I'll fly under it. I look at the bottom of it, and another odd thing, it was laying right on the surface of the ocean, which is unusual for a squall. I mean, well, usually there's rain on the bottom, but this is just laying right on the ocean. I figured, well, I'll maintain my course directivity like we were doing. And I went ahead and penetrated him into it. And it was a little bit strange going into it because there wasn't any rain at all. And that was good. But the lightning started flashing, and it was real odd lightning. It wasn't lightning bolts. It was just these flashes. And the deeper I went into it, the darker it became. It got to the point where when it would flash, I could see visibility was like over 2 miles. Then it would be pure black, and visibility would only be like 20 yards or something. Couldn't see anything but blackness. So we got to the point where the electricity got stronger the deeper we went. So we penetrated a mile or two in, and then I decided, well, that's too much. We got to get out of here. So I made a quick turn to the south and popped out of the storm, flew along the edge of it. Then I contacted Miami Air Traffic Control, the ones that told me that there wasn't any bad weather out there. And they said, I'll just give them a call when I get around the sun. They figured it's probably just a little storm that popped up. But I called them because I had deviated from the plan, flight plan. So I flew along the edge of it for a few minutes, and then I noticed it seems to be curving right back to the storm that we had come from. And then I could see that it is part of the storm we had cut from. And so this strange storm was circled all around us. I couldn't fly under it, and I couldn't fly over it. But then I see this strange event where the two ends of the storm were meeting. Apparently, it spread out right near Andros in the shape of a donut. And we just happened to go right over it when it started. And then the two ends met. Like, this is like 15 minutes later or so, on the opposite end, about 30 miles away. They met on the bottom first. And so there was like a big U-shaped valley in between the two storms. So I figured I'd shoot for that opening there, fly in between the two storms, head into the blue skies on the other side. That's when I went ahead and started aiming for it. It was almost due west, my heading. And as I approached it, the two tops of each side of the storm formed anvil heads. And that's like arms sticking out on either side. And then they connected. So now instead of a U-shaped valley for me to fly through, it had turned into like a tunnel. It was almost a perfect circle. And I had no choice. I asked my father what he thought, and he said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. We didn't have much choice, really. We wanted to get out. We're flying visual flight rules. That meant I wasn't supposed to be flying through the clouds. So I noticed it was the center of it was a little bit lower, so we started descending, and I noticed it was starting to close pretty rapidly, and so I increased the speed to full power, brought it right up to the red line, 230 miles an hour, and so when we reached the mouth of the tunnel, I leveled off. The tunnel appeared to be about 10 miles long and maybe 400 feet in diameter. So I figured, well, I should be able to make it to the other end, but actually I calculated incorrectly. It would have taken me like 3 minutes to reach the other end, and I've learned these tunnels usually only last 3 minutes. When the airplane penetrated the tunnel, that's when something incredible happened. Strange clouds formed all along the edge of the tunnel. They were just hovering off the walls of the tunnel, formed a line like a spiral. and it went all the way to the other end of the tunnel. The tunnel, not like that before the airplane went inside it. So I got to witness an incredible event. Apparently the airplane probably ignited this tunnel. I think what was happening was a time change just got started as soon as it penetrated the tunnel, because I was only in that tunnel for about 20 seconds. It should have taken me 3 minutes to reach the other end. If you can imagine what it looked like, what you can do is take like a quarter and put it in your two fingers, your thumb and finger, and take it and hold it out in front of your face, extend your arm, and that would be what the other end of the tunnel looked like. And it was pure blue sky on the other end of that, outside of that quarter that you're looking at. But here I'm going 230 miles an hour, and the tunnel's getting smaller, so I had to concentrate totally on the hole on the other end. And like I was saying, I think I got to witness time at this point. Space and time were creating a space warp. I was visually able to see it. And that's why these clouds were rotating around the airplane. I had to keep the plane level, or I would have rolled with it and concentrated on the other end. Part of Einstein's theory called length contraction. As you approach the speed of light, whatever you're traveling through contracts. It also takes less time for you to reach the other end. And the other thing that matches what I was experiencing is that what you're flying through begins to rotate around you. And that's what was happening while we were going through it. So when I came out, the wingtips scraped the edge of the tunnel, and then it collapsed right behind us, right as we came out of the tunnel. Then this is where the blue sky disappeared, and this is where I had a sensation that I've never felt before, only this one time, of zero gravity. I've felt that many times, but this was like a hydroplaning feeling, like I was skidding forward somehow. Along with the zero gravity, it lasted about 10 seconds. And while that's going on, the instruments, the navigational instruments on the airplane are all malfunctioning, and the compass is even spinning all by itself. The blue sky had instantly disappeared and turned into this strange, dark, gray-colored fog. And this is what I call electronic fog. To be in it, it's hard to explain what the visibility is when you're in it, because in a way the visibility looks good, but you can't really see anything. That's why it's hard to explain. No more horizon sky. Could kind of see the ocean below us, but it wasn't too clear. And I'm at 10,000 feet now. My dad, a great navigator, so I asked him to give us a position fix, and he fumbled with the instruments, and he said, something's wrong. And then I realized, that they're not working anymore. So I just kept going straight and maintained the heading that we were on, which was about 300 degrees, and kind of used the compass that I had developed in my mind to keep us straight. And I contacted the air traffic control, and that microphone was working anyway, so I asked them for our position. They couldn't locate it on radar. They said there's no planes in between Miami and Andros right now. So that didn't help any. Getting ready to sign off with the controller, and then my dad grabbed the microphone out of my hand, started yelling and screaming at him. He was going into a state of panic. I was able to calm him down and get the mic back. And then our passenger, Chuck, he's tapped me on the shoulder. He keeps talking to me, and he's not making any sense when he talks. it was like mumbling, and like all his words were like slurred, and couldn't comprehend him at all. So I had to kind of block him out of my mind and concentrate on flying the airplane. And that's what this electronic fog can do to you. It's been known to make people just pass out, make people panic, people go into a state of spatial disorientation, it's called. You get to the point where you're so confused, you start to get dizzy, and then you get so dizzy, there's not much you can do. But in that case, the airplane ends up going into a spiral. They call it a graveyard spiral. And that's happened many times to people that have disappeared. We're flying in this fog, electronic fog, for 3 minutes. Air traffic controller comes back and he's all excited. He's got an airplane directly over Miami Beach. And I look at my watch, we've only been flying for 33 minutes. When we entered that tunnel, we were 100 miles east of Miami. So only 3 minutes had passed. So I told him, no, we're probably 80 miles or so east of you guys. He says, are you sure? And then all of a sudden, another strange thing happens. The fog, the electronic fog, dissipates electronically. Like all these lines formed parallel to the direction of our flight. And then the lines cracked open. I could see the blue sky through the cracks. Then it got wider and wider, and then I could see Miami Beach right below us. So it didn't seem possible, but it was. And so I told the controller, we're still at 10,000 feet, and I said, yeah, you're right, great. He signed off. He didn't want me to sign off, though, because he knew something crazy just happened. But anyway, we went back to Palm Beach International, and when we landed, the flight had taken 47 minutes. Normally, the flight takes at least an hour and 20 minutes. So somehow there was some time missing. But I didn't understand time all that well back then. Neither could my passengers. And so we didn't think about it for a while. But I kept it in my mind and reviewed it every day because I knew something really significant had taken place. And that someday it would be important for the whole world to know about it.
In the book, you mentioned hearing something that said you need to remember this.
Right after the air traffic controller told us we were over Miami, and then I signed off with him, I heard this voice. It was a strong voice, and it wasn't my own voice. I even asked my dad if he heard that, what he said, and my dad said, heard what? Apparently, I was the only one that could hear it. It said to always remember what I had just experienced, because someday it will be important for the whole world to know about. And now, 53 years later, I never thought I'd still be talking about it, but the world is learning about it. I think quite a few people have heard about it. Hopefully someday mainstream science will hear about it and do something about it.
You say the electronic fog is an experience a lot of people have reported it, even though it isn't considered to be legit science, but that doesn't have anything to do with when someone feels it and they experience it. Sometimes that's the only way we have a way of starting to track it. And you've tracked it. You've got videos that you've tried to explain, this is what it's like, this is what it feels like. And you've also identified some other cases where this may have happened. They may have experienced the very same thing you did. They just didn't survive.
Well, I know there are some pilots that have flown through these tunnels. I learned about them when I was only 17 years old from my first flight instructor. He called them sucker holes. And he said they're usually a couple miles high, and they form inside storms. And he said, don't ever fly through one of those. And he said he personally knew a pilot, a friend of his, flew through one. And he disappeared. And I thought maybe he meant that he crashed. Now I think he was saying it wasn't only just a crash, it was something strange that he disappeared. And there's been a lot of planes that have disappeared. And that's where this idea of portals come in. It seems to be related to a portal. And I've been told a story that about a jet pilot that flew into the electronic fog. He was out over the Pacific. And he was able to land on another island, and it ended up it was in another dimension, another reality. I mean, it's a long story, but to keep it short, I mean, somehow he was able to come back from this island that actually had people on it, and they helped him to leave. He came back and survived. And he didn't tell anybody about it for over 20 years until recently.
Bruce Gernon, Bermuda Triangle survivor, his personal story. The previous book we talked about is in the archives, Beyond the Bermuda Triangle, True Encounters with Electronic Fog, Missing Aircraft, and Time Warps, written by Bruce Gernon, along with author Rob McGregor. Again, Bermuda Triangle survivor, Bruce Gernon.
A perspective from Joe McMonagle takes it into UFO territory.
Joe is an incredible person. He was the first and number one, they called him remote viewer for the Army. And it's for real. I used to think, that can't be real. But it's real. And he proved it to me once. We gave him envelopes with the questions. This is the way he does. He's so used to doing it this way. He takes the envelope and he doesn't open it up. And he knows what the question is. He explained that it was 1 year later that I encountered a UFO. It was a flying saucer. And it was in the same area. It was at night. And I was flying over Miami, and then I headed out for Bimini. And for some reason, here I am at 10,000 feet. And the same flight path I was on when I came through this experience that I had. And when I got about 5 miles offshore, we saw this strange amber light way out near Bimini. And, I had a group lady friend with me. She saw it, too. And we kept watching it. We couldn't figure out what it was. And then all of a sudden, it just shot right toward us on a collision course. And it got so big that it took up almost the whole windshield at one point. It must have been 200-300 feet in diameter. This shape with a dome on the top. And so I turned the airplane sharp as I could to the left. I thought we were going to dive. As soon as I made the turn, I looked back and it was gone. It just vanished. Joe was answering the question, one of the questions was, did we see this, anything odd? You know? And then he explained what I just said in detail. And then he even drew it. He's a pretty good artist with a pencil. And he drew what the flying saw looked like. It was amazing. And he had added two tails on the back, kind of like a fighter jet, twin tails. But it didn't have any tails. He didn't get that right. So then, I don't know, it was months later, maybe years. And I took him fishing along with Rob McGregor, one of my co-authors. We had a great time down the Keys, and I had a place down there. And I was thinking he was kind of a spooky guy, but no, he's quite normal. But then there was one strange part, though. He comes up to me, and he's real serious all of a sudden. This is at night. We're just laying back watching TV or something. He says, remember that flying saucer I drew for you? I said, yeah. He said, it didn't have tails, did it? I said, yeah, that's right, yeah, it didn't have any tails in it like you drew on there. He says, God bless us, how did I can't believe I did that. And then it's like, I don't know, maybe a year later, I'm going through my documents, and I look at the part where I saved Joe McMonagle's work, and I look at the flying saucer that he drew, and the tails were gone. I said, what? How could that be? I mean, I didn't talk to him or communicate with him at all. I said, the tails were gone. Somehow, mentally, I guess, he made the tails disappear. Hard to believe.
That's amazing. And so the explanation for that, how could that happen?
I don't know. I swear it happened. He's an incredible person. Even his best friend, Rob McGregor, was pretty surprised when I told him that story. But he believed it too. Believed it really happened.
There are some amazing stories with Joe and the other one, Pat Price, who also was a remote viewer. There was an experience where you were on the beach and you saw the discs flying by, and I think there were five.
Yeah, it was like a couple of years after I made the flight. Just before I saw those, I took a trip to North Carolina Ski Resort. We went commercial airlines, my wife and I. Before we went on the plane, I just had like a vision, and I thought that we would see a flying saucer on the way back in the commercial plane. We brought our camera, so on the way back, we made sure we got a window seat that faced towards the ocean and the Bermuda Triangle. We're starting our descent into Palm Beach International, and we got to probably a couple thousand feet or so. We look out over the ocean, here's this huge glowing orange flying saucer cruising right offshore. Just like the one that I saw, it came out, almost ran into me. It had this, had a dome on the top of it. And it was like scattered cumulus clouds at about 2,000 to 3,000 feet. And it was going in and out of the clouds. And when it would go in the cloud, the whole cloud would light up orange. It would glow orange. And then it would come out. We took a bunch of pictures of it, and they came out, but we didn't have the proper lens to really get good pictures. But in one of them, you can see that it does have a dome on the top of it. That was pretty incredible. I thought that I knew that we were going to see one. So then I started thinking, and it's like, you know what, I'm going to see some more flying saucers, maybe more than one, if I go to the beach tomorrow night. I just knew we were going to be able to see them. So I took my wife to the beach. After it got dark, I guess I knew when they were going to come, too. And so here comes the first one, from the same north, heading south, only this time they're further offshore, probably a couple miles, maybe, a mile. And they're going fast, maybe, I don't know, could be close to 1,000 miles an hour. And this time I had my binoculars, which they had zoom lens on, battery-powered zoom. After the first one disappeared, it came from the left, and it disappeared to the right. But as soon as it disappeared to the right, here comes another one on the same path on the left. And so I took out the zoom lenses and zoomed in on it, and sure as heck, it was the same one again. Only this time there were more than one. With this orange glow, with the dome on the top. Flying saucers, maybe 200 feet in diameter. And then as soon as the second one disappears to our right, here comes the third one. It was incredible just watching them. And here comes the fourth one. And then here comes the last one. And then when the last one got right even with us, it makes a 90-degree turn with no curve, had no radius to the turn. It was a square turn. And it aims right for us. And went right over our head, maybe 1,500 feet up. When it got right over us, it blinked two lights, a red and then a green. When it left, it went out of sight, out to the west this time. My co-author in one of the books, Rod McGregor, wrote a magazine story about that. It did that. It was as if the last one was saluting me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Gernon salute. That is incredible for it to get directly over you and then give that signal, the green light and the red light, or red light and green light, the timing. With the missing time, do you think there is any kind of connection or contact between you and this anomaly?
Absolutely. Back then, it was like I was communicating with him. I communicated with him once when I was in the third grade.
In the third grade?
That's another. Yeah. And then they communicated with me again after I experienced that flight through the for me to triangle. And then again, later when the UFOs were out there that I just talked about.
Yeah.
Ever since then, I really haven't been able to communicate with them. Some people actually can't seem that they can communicate with them, or they claim they communicate with them anyway, but I've tried to communicate with them, but I haven't been successful. It's like they communicate with me sometimes, but I can't communicate with them. And maybe it's because I really don't want to meet them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, from what Joe described, it might be a little bit intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They take control of you when you get to meet them.
And that seems like it's a self-preservation thing, because we tend to be a little bit aggressive.
Yeah, we're like animals compared to them.
You do also have on your website, and these are on the YouTube channel, your granddaughter. You guys were outside and watching the storm clouds, and there's a square in the clouds.
Yeah, that's got some pictures of these tunnels that form in between thunderstorm cells, they call them. This was the first time I ever videoed one, and it was over the Everglades. And I had another experience with electronic fog over the Everglades in 1996. And my wife was with me this time, so she's a witness. And we've got a bunch of videos that we've made on YouTube, and they're under the channel they call it Bermuda Files. So we did a video of the experience we had over the Everglades. We experienced electronic fog. My wife was scared to death. I was a little scared that time, too. If you watch the video, you get to see what happens. It happened a few times over the Everglades. It's kind of a spawning ground for these thunderstorms. That's where this one was, over the Everglades. So we photographed it and also videoed. The one that's called Are There Wormholes on Planet Earth? You go to that one, right around 11 minutes, you'll find the video and some still shots of this storm. And an incredible thing about this storm, it was hexagonal. And that's one of the theories. Mainstream science says that these hexagonal clouds can form dangerous winds. And there's something unusual about them, because they're square turns, which is not normal in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at this still shot of this thunderstorm, you see there's a tunnel. It's about 5 miles long. And in the first forms, it's a lot bigger. It's probably 1,000 feet in diameter or more. And then after a few minutes, it gets down to only 50 feet, 100 feet in diameter. It usually only lasts 3 minutes or so. But when this one got down to, after a few minutes, it was going to close in about 20 seconds. It turned square. It turned hexagonal. It was really strange, and you can definitely see it in the photograph. It's a hexagonal tunnel, 5 miles long and perfectly horizontal. So it's similar to what I flew through, something like that. Mine was round, though. It's perfectly horizontal. Nobody flies through them, because you'd have to be out of your mind to fly through one. I hope it's one of these days of scientists, and NASA already has a drone that has all kinds of scientific instruments on it. That would be the thing to fly through one of these. And they did take the drone to Key West once and spent some time studying thunderstorms. But to find one of these tunnels is quite rare. So it's not going to be easy for them, even though they have the capability. And nobody can predict when the tunnels are going to form.
I just wonder if that is it being activated from another dimension.
Well, it may have something to do with another dimension. I mean, it definitely has something to do with time. There's absolutely no doubt about that. It'll change space and time if you get caught in it.
At one point, when I was reading, I read your information, and I remember we were driving west and watching the clouds, storm clouds in front of me, and seeing a square in the clouds and thinking, how the heck can it make a square? That's not supposed to happen. Square window, you know, blue sky and storm clouds around it. And I'm watching that as it gradually gets smaller, but just perplexed, wondering, is this possible? But reading your information, it is possible, and something else is happening.
Yeah, it's like a window. to another dimension of sound. That's amazing. Yeah, that, it can happen all over the world.
If I hadn't been reading your information, I would have just thought, well, that's, you know, that's weird, that's unusual, and not even thought about it again, because there's nowhere to go with it. For me, you know, it's like, well, that was unusual, I saw it, and that's the end of it. But when I was able to make the connection of, this is what you're talking about, like you said, a portal, a window, an opening to a different dimension, well, that makes a lot more sense, because squares and windows, you know, in clouds, that is something that we're taught to look for circles. And squares don't make sense.
Right. And when it collapses, that's when it emits like a sphere of this electronic fog. And then the electronic fog can last for many hours after that. And it still has the ability to affect time and maybe even make you disappear. Not too sure about that, but...
David Pilates does shows on missing people and missing persons. One I remember, and this was a little girl who had disappeared in the woods, the forest, and they were about ready to give up looking for her. I think she was three, a toddler, and they were ready to give up looking for her, and they describe her walking out of the fog after being gone for 3 or 4 days, just completely normal, no problems, and the way she appeared, though, walking out of the fog. Those things, I think, are a characteristic of something else that's going on that we don't understand.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we wouldn't understand that. It does happen to people. I've talked to a lot of people that have had experiences where they had like a time experience. Some of them just kind of lose time. It has something to do with fog, too. Like only a minute or two passes, then when they snap out of it, 2 or 3 hours have passed. I've talked to a bunch of people on the ground where they've had that experience, either just walking or in a car. So, yeah, it can happen on the ground. It's most dangerous for planes, though.
You're willing to give a presentation to anybody. You say you've started with groups of children, third grade and up, and they may be the ones who actually solve these issues.
Absolutely. I feel real strong about that. They will be the ones that will solve it. It's just as important as, like, figuring out lightning. It's going to take a long time. You know, it's like, how long did it take them to figure out lightning? A couple hundred years? It's similar to that. And it's just as important as lightning and electricity, because it's going to be all about time. It's going to affect time. We're going to learn how to control time.
Do you think that there is more information to come from that voice that said, this is going to be really important, so remember it?
Well, yeah, that's one of my abilities that I had when I was seeing these UFOs, too. I had visions of the future. I can sort of see like a video in my mind. Definitely it's going to be real important in the future, especially after I'm gone.
What will it help us do?
It will help you to go to other stars, find another planet similar to Earth.
Space travel.
Yeah, instead of Mars. You're not going to find a lot of things on Mars. You can't travel fast enough. Once we learn how to control time, there are some scientists trying to figure out how I experienced this. The doctor that I work with, David Parrish from the University of Nebraska, he's been working hard on this for over 10 years with me. I've been on TV with him about 4 or 5 times. He thinks it's a warp bubble. He thinks when I came out of the tunnel, I was in a warp bubble. This electronic fog that was around the airplane was the warp bubble. And so the space behind me was contracting, and the space in front of me was just the opposite. So I was traveling through time, in other words. The theory is a Mexican scientist named Miguel Alcubierre that created this theoretically, and even NASA's picking up on it now. They're working on creating a warp bubble, which will go faster than time, actually, once you get it going. So that's what happened to me. When the fog attached to me, I was in this warp bubble. And then I came out of it right over my hand. But then there could be another theory where I was transported. And this is the one I kind of go along with. While I was inside that tunnel, I mean, something really incredible happened, and I could see it. most amazing part of the whole experience. So I was 100 miles in, away from Miami when I entered the mouth of that tunnel. When I came out of the exit of that tunnel, I believe that what happened was the fog was already attached to me, but I came out of the tunnel 10 miles offshore of Miami. And so then it took me what would be normal is 3 minutes to fly to Miami. And then the fog dissipated. So in other words, I was teleported like 80 or 90 miles. Didn't have to look at it while I was inside the tunnel. It would be like a wormhole. That's how a wormhole would work. You go in one end of the wormhole, and when you come out the other, you're in a different place in a different time. That's what I think happened. It all took place inside the tunnel, and they've recently come out with quantum entanglement theory, where it's possible. They've actually done that, transported in the laboratory.
It takes one person to have this kind of experience and be able to coherently put the pieces together for other people to figure out how the math is possible. But until someone experiences it, it doesn't exist.
Not in mainstream science. Yeah, they need more data. Eventually they'll get it, but it's taken a long time.
The fact that you're able now to start connecting dots with other people and other experiencers, then there's something to work with.
I'm trying to get people to contact me on the website. For some reason, all kinds of people with companies have made stories about what I experienced. They don't always get it right, though. But I got it.
Yeah.
I got it all the way it's supposed to be if you go on my website to view the files. It's hardly anybody that leaves me a message where I go to these other ones that were made out. And it would be hundreds, maybe 1,000 people have been communicating with them.
Your website, electronicfog.com, that's where you have the links for your YouTube channel and your books.
If they got any data that I can put in my files, it'd be great, because I'll save it and try to pass it on to scientists.
I appreciate you telling your story and continuing to keep moving it forward, especially adding on your UFO experiences, because I think it gave you more permission to talk about it after the New York Times article was published in 2017, where they finally said, oh, yeah, this is real, after denying it for 50-some years.
Yeah, times are changing, you know, with the UAPs now. That's made a difference. You know, I wouldn't talk about it so much before, but now I do talk about it.
It made you a target. The minute you said, well, I saw one, let alone I experienced one and I saw an ET, then, you know, or I heard something, then that was like automatic dismissal and ridicule. So now, with at least the admission of, okay, we have seen these, they do exist, and our military can't compare. So that gives permission to say, all right, yeah, they are real. Beyond that, then we're now looking for an okay on the experiencers.
Right, yeah.
That's the next step.
We're changing for the good.
So. Yeah, yeah.
You say that.
Crossing my fingers, you'll have more contact with the UFOs.
Yeah, I haven't seen one in a while.
Bruce Gernon, Bermuda Triangle survivor, tells the story of what he experienced. And Bruce Gernon and Rob McGregor tell the story beyond the Bermuda Triangle, true encounters with electronic fog, missing aircraft, and time warps. Website electronicfog.com. Links are in the description to the show. Thanks for listening.